my personality to be jittery. It's part of my charm.
Wrestling fans,
are you ready?
It's time for my 1-2-3 cents of a podcast on the Jittery Monkey Podcasting Network.
Give me a hell yeah!
Now, here's your host.
The man is also a very long, dear personal friend of mine.
Does the guy have a name?
Yes, he has a name.
Kevin Huntsberger.
Woo!
Time to rumble! It's time for the Royal Rumble! Participants include the immortal Hulk Hogan, the Hitman Bret Hart, Animal from Legion of Doom, the Undertaker, the Tugboat, the model Rick Martel, Mr. Perfect.
Hey friends, welcome to episode 323 of the My 1-2-3 Cents podcast. And as you have probably figured it out, we are talking about the 1991 Royal Rumble. And I cannot believe it was just, we just passed the 30-year anniversary of this event. My co-host this week is Chad Smart, once again, of the Positive Cynicism Podcasting Network and the soon-to-be Movie Mania podcast, which is still part of the My 1-2-3 Cents podcast. We'll do that once a month. And I think, Chad, we have decided that fighting with my family is going to be the winner after putting up a poll and getting a little bit of response. And hopefully the My 1-2-3 Cents group on Facebook will get a little more traction in the coming weeks as well, and we get more participation when we post polls and do those such things.
Yeah, I mean, hopefully that's, you know, over at Positive Cynicism, I do a show called Wonder Why, where we look at one-hit wonders. And when we started the show, which I can't believe was 4 years ago, but we would throw up a poll, three choices to see which one-hit wonder people wanted to talk about. And after about 6 months, we took that poll away because it was very disappointing, the numbers we were getting. But it's still a good series, and I would recommend checking it out. We have a new thing going on that comes out. Our next episode comes out the day after this episode drops, and we are actually this year looking at one-hit wonders that aren't, or mistaken one-hit wonders. It's actually people who you consider a one-hit wonder but have more than one hit. So it's good to be back with you talking wrestling and Movie Mania. I'm looking forward to it. I was kind of disappointed that Breakfast with Blassie didn't win. I'm hoping somewhere down the line we can take a look at that, because I did start watching that, and it seems very interesting. But I have fighting with my family stories, fighting with my family. So
there you go.
It'll be great. Yeah.
Well, I'm looking forward to that, and we'll eventually watch My Breakfast with Blassie, even if we do it as a bonus episode. But
yeah, we got to get that Patreon going.
Yeah, exactly. I want to talk to you, kind of set the table for fandom-wise in 1991, and kind of let people know, because obviously in today's environment, you know, you can watch virtually anything that the WWE produced thanks to the WWE Network, which we went back and rewatched this show to prep for the podcast. But in 1991, were you watching pay-per-views? I know you've told stories before, you had the big satellite dish in your backyard. Were you able to watch this event in real time, or did you have to wait and watch it later?
Yeah, by this time, scrambling had become a thing. So just because you had a satellite, you couldn't watch it. You needed a scrambler, and you had to order the pay-per-view. So I did not watch this live. I believe, if memory serves correct, that I had a friend who had ordered it and taped it. And then a group of friends got together a few days later and watched it. But, you know, and no internet, I don't think anything had been spoiled by the time we actually watched it either.
Yeah. And my quick story on that is I also had a friend who had the big satellite dish in his backyard. This actually went down on January 19th, 1991, which was a Saturday night, which was not the norm for WWE pay-per-views, as we come to know that Sunday has been deemed that tradition. However, this was on a Saturday night, and my friend recorded it. I was working, I believe, and he ended up letting me borrow the VHS copy after he recorded it, but he did spoil it for me and told me that the Ultimate Warrior had lost the championship, and I did not believe him. And we'll get more into that when we get to that match in our podcast here. But so I didn't have the internet spoilers, but I had him spoiling. But since I didn't believe him, I watched it anyway, and then I was doubly surprised. But we'll get to that in a few minutes. Chad and I, by the way, both were in high school when this went down. I was a senior, Chad was a junior, and this is also the time of kind of setting the table before we get to the Rumble itself. With world events going on, and the United States was invading or going into the Middle East. I shouldn't say we were invading, but...
Yeah, we don't invade. We're America. We save.
We were moving in because Iraq had moved into Kuwait, and I don't know all the political ramifications of it, but I remember the summer of 1990 leading up to all this, being with a group of friends and hearing that there was tension going on more so than typical in the Middle East, and not really thinking that it was going to lead to what it eventually led to. But do you have any memories of this time period? You know, because we were both obviously old enough to go back and remember. And, you know, mm-hmm. There were people in my friend group that were concerned about perhaps even being drafted because of the unease going on.
Yeah, I mean, I don't remember being drafted, but I remember the war going on. And I think I had a different T-shirt for every day of the week supporting troops and supporting America. And I just remember that I had a cousin who was in the Navy at the time, and he was actually, his ship was the first to take Iraqi, I don't want to say hostages because that sounds weird, but soldiers, they captured soldiers. And then talking to him, he's like, yeah, it really wasn't that impressive. They just kind of came up and went like, we give up, take us in. Like, I don't think they wanted to fight either. But yeah, I mean, it was, you know, it's weird that, not to get all political, but you look at the history of the United States and how many wars we've been in and how often we are at war. But, you know, for our generation, that was the first kind of big war since Vietnam, which right. You know, we were both too young to fully remember.
Well, and, I wasn't born when Vietnam happened, so I know I'm old, well, but I wasn't around for Vietnam.
Didn't it end in like
I guess 73. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Until they started making movies about it. I'm like, right. That's not a real thing. That's not a real country. But yeah, it's, I remember being, you know, I didn't think it would lead to like world war, mm-hmm. but you just never know. And, you know, it was over in, I think like 31 days, 32 days.
Right.
So I think how quickly it ended, I think, is one of the reasons why we've been in the Middle East for so long later on when things started back up, because I think we were expecting. But anyway, that's a whole nother show. That's, we can say that for if I bring Political Calamity back on the Positive Cynicism podcast. But yeah, no, just, you know, looking at it in the terms of wrestling, you know, as we get into it. Yeah, I think it had more of an overreach than it should have had.
Right. And that's why we're bringing this up specifically, because at the same time, you know, during that summer when everything's kind of building up, Sergeant Slaughter has returned to the WWF after a several year hiatus. And when he left, he was the All-American Hero, the G.I. Joe. You know, G.I. Joe had actually made Sergeant Slaughter a character. But Slaughter had left and competed in the AWA and was, you know, not seen from for several years on WWF television. Then he returns as an Iraqi sympathizer. Chad, was this blurring the lines too much with reality and wrestling? You know, he burned. Did he burn the American? There was controversy with him burning something. I think, was it an actual flag? I don't remember now.
I don't remember.
Your recall's probably worse than mine.
Yes. I don't recall if he,
I know he burned Hulk Hogan's shirt.
I think he just threw the flag away or took the flag off his flagpole and put up the Iraqi flag. I don't think they went as far as burning the flag. Yeah. But, I mean, that wouldn't surprise me. At the time, because it was easier to suspend disbelief when I was younger and pre-internet dealings, I was into the storyline. Like, I was like, ooh, evil Sergeant Slaughter. How could you side with the Iraqis? Watching back now and looking at it, I do think, not that it was too much, but it just, it was one of those things that you're like, okay, do we have to go there? I mean, I would compare it to, you know, after, you know, when ISIS was coming up and they brought in Muhammad Assad, mm-hmm. and made that character. Yeah, it's like one of those things where I think part of the reason we watch wrestling is for escape, mm-hmm. and to have current events being thrown in there doesn't always work well.
Right. And, you know, there's all kinds of rumors that were leading up to WrestleMania in 1991 that they were going to do it at the big Coliseum in LA. And apparently there was a low ticket sales. They chalked it up to there being threats. Because I do remember a lot of bomb threats and a lot of unease and tension in those months, you know, during the conflict in the Middle East. But I don't know what the true story is there, but I feel like, and I kind of wanted to get your opinion on this too. I felt like 1990 and then 91, really, it kind of sped the process up. But I felt like as a fan looking back now, 1990 was a really pivotal year for professional wrestling in terms of kind of changing that overall landscape, because on the other channel with WCW, you know, the deal with Turner is being finalized. We're kind of breaking off of that NWA championship and calling it WCW now. Sting becomes the world champion over there. The Ultimate Warrior becomes the WWF champion. You know, we see icons, Hulk Hogan and Ric Flair kind of take a back seat of sorts for much of the rest of 1990. And then, you know, we carry into 1991, and then immediately the new year starts, and both of those guys lose the championships, and Hogan eventually gets it back. But I don't feel like Hulk Hogan nor Ric Flair were ever the same in terms of, I don't know. And obviously it was a new decade. These guys are both now, you know, Flair was 40. Hogan's getting closer to 40, which is not old by any means. But back then in wrestling, 40 felt old. And I don't know. Am I wrong here? Did you notice or feel like there was a difference? Because we tried Sting, we tried Ultimate Warrior, and, you know, eventually go back to what we're most familiar with. But it didn't, to me, it didn't feel the same this time around.
You know, I don't think I looked at it that way. I would say, now looking back with hindsight, I think, you know, Flair taking the title because of the botched Black Scorpion storyline, that mm-hmm. probably had an effect where if it had been one of the original choices under the mask instead of Flair, and yeah. Sting hadn't lost the title to Flair a month later, it might have worked. And I, you know, I'm a Flair mark, so other than what he's doing currently in WWE, which is just sad and depressing. But, you know, I was a Flair fan all the way up through the end of WCW. So Hogan, you know, and then I'm sure we'll get into this when we start discussing the Rumble match itself. I've said on the show, I was only a Hulkamaniac until after WrestleMania 1. And that was because I hated Roddy Piper so much and wanted to see him get his comeuppance. I never cared for Hogan on top, and him bringing the title again in the storyline that they're presenting, I think Hogan made sense, but he was also like, yeah, I wanted someone else. I didn't care for Hogan. And even when he went to WCW, I was like, you know, and I mean, that was worse because then you're like, he's on Flair's territory and mm-hmm. making Flair look weak. But no, I don't think I wouldn't have looked at it as, you know, either status quo or just these guys not being the same. I think obviously there was a shifting in the direction of both companies. And like you said, you know, WWF at the time went so cartoony in the early 90s that I think that hurt their product. Whereas WCW was going, you know, especially when they started Nitro bringing in the cruiserweights, and you were looking at more guys that were more athletic and doing more, but then you still had Hogan and Flair and, you know, all the guys on top that were kind of that old school mentality. So I think that as you get later in the decade, definitely I think there was a change, but.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, by the end of 1991, the year that we're specifically talking about, Flair has jumped ship to the WWF. Sid Justice is now in the WWF. So you have a couple of big time players that were in WCW, and you still have the Road Warriors who had jumped over, you know, right before, you know, during the summer of 1990. So you have some of these WCW guys that are in the WWF. And to me, that was always kind of an odd thing too, because I do feel like there were times that mm-hmm. Vince McMahon or creative may have neutered or, you know, kind of changed and taken away from what made them so big or so popular on the other channel. So it's just, I don't know. I was thinking about it as I was watching the Rumble and prepping for this show. It's just kind of those changes that were going on and kind of the benefit of hindsight. And I'm sure later this summer, we'll talk more about Flair's jump and, you know, the significance of all of that. But let's get back on to the Rumble here. And we're not going to go through every match, and, you know, people can watch it and go back and look and see. The two matches on the undercard I do want to talk about, though, and we'll save the championship match for after this tag team match. Ted DiBiase and Virgil beating Dustin Rhodes and Dusty Rhodes, which, again, 30 years ago, Dustin Rhodes still wrestling, probably in better shape now than he was in this match back 30 years ago. You had said that you kind of had forgotten about the undercard. This was, I believe, also Dusty's last appearance, or at least last television appearance in the WWF for that run.
Yeah, I mean, when I was looking at the matches, I saw this one come up, and I was like, oh, okay. I didn't, you know, I don't remember when the whole Dustin storyline had happened. If you had asked me previous what year that was, I wouldn't have been able to tell you. But I mean, I thought this was a good way to introduce Dustin into because he then left and went to WCW and became the natural Dustin mm-hmm. Rhodes, correct? Right, and then came back obviously as Goldust. But I thought this was, you know, a good storyline at the time, and obviously with Dustin's inexperience, even though Virgil's in there and wasn't treated as a serious wrestler.
Yeah.
I think DiBiase going over was probably the right call. And you would think that they would have done something more with Dustin going on. But then again, I'm not sure when he left to go. And if Dusty left shortly after this, it would make sense that nothing, you know, further came along of it.
Yeah. I don't know. I didn't look it up, but I am just from my recall and reading the old magazines, I'm almost positive that Dusty may have wrestled Sergeant Slaughter a couple times after this, but was gone probably before the end of the month. And I think Dustin left with him, and then they showed back up in WCW where Dusty, I think, started booking right away again. And I don't think he wrestled again really until a few years later when he and Dustin teamed up in the War Games match. And I don't remember all the players in that, but I think part of the Stud Stable and the Nasty mm-hmm. Boys were involved, but I thought that this was an interesting tag team match. I thought because of Virgil, and the whole point of this match was to set up the Virgil face turn and have him and Ted, you know, that was the story mm-hmm. more so than the father son teaming up for the first time and whatnot. But I don't know. I thought Virgil, I don't know. Virgil was Virgil to me. I just never took him, like you said, they didn't really bill him as a serious wrestler in this match. And even after he turned and, you know, I think he won the $1 million championship for a brief period. But besides that, he pretty much became enhancement talent pretty quick, I think, with, mm-hmm. You know, I remember he was Yokozuna's debut opponent. I think Nails beat him at SummerSlam 1 year. So I never really took Virgil too seriously after that, although I thought, you know, as Ted DiBiase's bodyguard was obviously his legacy and his claim to fame, I think.
Yeah, I am with you 100%. Yeah, he's, you know, and then especially when going to WCW and being the NWO's kind of lackey, like it just, yeah. And I think maybe that's, you know, also, you know, 20 years down the road of hindsight, like, yeah, I don't know what he did pre, you know, Virgil status in WWF. So, yeah, he would kind of be like, I'm trying to think of a current wrestler that you could throw in there as a comparison. But yeah, I think if I can pull a Conrad Thompson reference, I would say, Kevin, what is your favorite Virgil match and why don't you have one?
Yeah, exactly. And I do know, you know, not to totally crap all over the guy, I don't know if it was Memphis or it was somewhere in the South that he did wrestle. I believe as Soul Train Jones. I remember again from the magazines and seeing him, you know, he obviously had a good look, but again, once, and then the bell rang, as they say, and didn't he not too very long ago appear on AEW as well? And did they call him Virgil or what did they call him when he was there?
I think they called him Soul Train Jones. Yeah. He was in a pre-tape just giving his opinion on, I think, a Cody Rhodes match or maybe the TNT championship tournament, okay, something like that. But yeah, I completely forgot about that. But yes, you're correct.
So, you know, obviously kind of the most memorable thing on the 1991 Royal Rumble is Sergeant Slaughter winning the WWF championship because, again, it was an unlikely match. He was an unlikely contender, in my opinion. You know, although the signs were there, the WWF was building up Slaughter to be a top heel, but I didn't think he was going to be the guy. You still had the Macho King Randy Savage, who was, you know, even though he'd been around for a while, I still felt like he had that energy and he had that, you know, ultimate bad guy persona. You know, people hated him after the whole Hogan turn. Ravishing Rick Rude, who I personally would have rather seen inserted into this matchup and then lead to a Hogan-Rude WrestleMania matchup. But obviously Rick Rude is gone by this point and he left in the fall of 1990. But if you go down the roster, other than like Mr. Perfect, who was the Intercontinental Champion, there were no other big time heels. Like we're back in this time period again, where you have the two dominant guys in the company are both good guys, Hogan and Warrior. And they had said they weren't going to do a rematch between the two of them. I would have rather seen that, quite honestly, at WrestleMania 7, Hogan versus Warrior Part 2, than to see Sergeant Slaughter as the champion. But then we wouldn't have gotten the awesome Savage-Warrior matchup. So lots to unpack there with Savage and his interference. You know, what were your overall thoughts? You know, Sergeant Slaughter, again, a championship run in 84, 85, I would have bought. You know, mm-hmm. He was that over and that popular. 1991, you know, again, age is just a number, but he's in his 40s. He doesn't look like your prototypical wrestler. I just had a hard time buying him as champ.
Well, first, I want to say I thought you were going to go with your, you know, big surprise main event match from this show being either Big Boss Man and the Barbarian or the Mountie and Coco Beware. But
stellar matches, but yeah.
And just for the record, Big Boss Man and Barbarian, according to Wikipedia, went 14 minutes and 15 seconds. Slaughter and Warrior went 12 minutes, 47 seconds. So whoever gave Boss Man and Barbarian nearly a quarter of an hour fired. Yeah, you know, I am not a fan of rematches at WrestleMania. That's why, you know, the ones that we went to, the fact that we got Cena and Rock 2 years in a row, I was not happy about, especially since the first time was billed as once in a lifetime. And it's one of my reasons for, you know, I don't consider the Attitude Era to be as great as everyone else, because how many, you know, you had three WrestleManias where it was Stone Cold and The Rock, mm-hmm. and they didn't have anybody else that they would put into there. So I'm glad we didn't get a Warrior Hogan 2 matchup. Again, you just look at the storyline being told, Vince McMahon being all pro America, I think we could have seen the storyline coming that evil Iraqi sympathizer Sergeant Slaughter gets vanquished by all American hero Hulk Hogan. I'm with you. I think you could have told that story without the title on the line as well. And, yeah, you know, could have kept Warrior as champ and going into, like you said, still get the Warrior Savage match, you know, where it could be title versus career. Yeah. But
yeah,
you know, I mean, I think Warrior was gone shortly after this as well, if memory serves right.
Yeah, he left after he ran out of the SummerSlam match in 1991. It was Hogan and Warrior against Sergeant Slaughter,
Adnan.
So,
You know, and you know, you can buy into all the backstage drama that has come out since then about Vince and Warrior's relationship, and who knows what was going on at the time. But and I think, you know, this is one of the problems that we have, that wrestling has, and you kind of talked about it earlier, is you're going back to the well eventually with Hogan on top, which is, you know, how many times have we seen guys on top that have stayed there too long just because, well, they were successful for 4 years, obviously they'll be successful for 10 years. And it's like, no, we kind of want something new. But yeah, I think the storyline obviously in place made sense. I don't think we needed it, but
do you insert someone else though to be that Iraqi sympathizer? Because allegedly there was a rumor that Tugboat, who eventually did turn heel, and actually I had forgotten, kind of went after Hogan in this match, and Hogan eliminated him from the Rumble. You know, would someone other than Sergeant Slaughter? Because again, and not knocking the age factor by any means, but I just felt like Sergeant Slaughter was past his optimal time, but he did, you know, he did what the whole point was to be that transitional champion to get it back to Hulk Hogan. But do you find someone else to, you know, I guess from the time the Iraq conflict was starting in August to get that number one contender built up by January for the Royal Rumble, you know, Sergeant Slaughter really was the best choice because he had already been established. Fans knew who he was. He had credibility. Whereas if you're trying to build someone and make them a believable contender, when you're not doing weekly or monthly pay-per-views and you're not doing that, you know, weekly 5 hours of programming, it's probably more difficult, I guess, back in that era. Today, it probably could have been done. But, you know, we can sit here and fantasy book and do hindsight 2020 all we want. But, I mean, ultimately, pun intended, I guess, at the end of the day, I was happy with the Warrior Savage match at WrestleMania. And then, you know, Hogan Slaughter was fine. It was what it was. And it was a vehicle, again, to get Hogan back as the champion. So, but I think also, and I wonder if the conflict in Iraq ending as quickly as it did, by the time WrestleMania rolled around, it was over with. Like you said, it was 31 or 32 days. So by that point, do we have a dead angle that nobody, you know, are the fans really still that invested in it? You know, I know Slaughter lingered for another 6 months as a bad guy, but then turned good right after that SummerSlam match. So I don't know. Sometimes that's, I guess, where you get shot in the foot when you incorporate too much of the world events into your storytelling.
The only other person I could think that you could throw in there would have been Corporal Kirshner, who was brought in as kind of a replacement to Slaughter when Slaughter left. But I don't think he ever took off the way, you know, he was never, I think, on the same level as Sergeant Slaughter was. Right. So bringing Slaughter in, yeah, I think it's probably, if you're going to do the story, is probably the only major name that you could easily insert, and without having to do, like you said, 6 months of buildup to get him as a contender. But yeah, I agree with you that by the time the Iraqi war was over, you know, do we care about Iraqi sympathizer Slaughter? Like, and I think it's one of those things where even without the internet, it was a storyline that was not believable. You know, it wasn't as realistic. You're like, okay, this is clearly a storyline. Like, Sergeant Slaughter is not, you know, hanging out with Saddam Hussein and all this. It's whereas, you know, the Warrior Savage angle, they're, you know, that blurring the line of, do these guys actually dislike each other? And because, you know, just because of personality, like Savage, like you said, was so intense, and Warrior is Warrior. Like, it came off better. Whereas Slaughter Hogan just seemed like a wrestling angle.
Yeah, and you know, back to the you know, Sergeant Slaughter is defending the championship at WrestleMania 7. At WrestleMania 8, he's in an 8-man tag team with Hacksaw and I believe it was the Big Boss Man and Virgil against the Nasty Boys, the Mountie, and I don't remember who the eighth guy was, but you know, Repo Man, I think. You know, so that also within that year, how much his stock plunged, and you know, again, the ultimate transitional champion. And to me, like I said, when my friend told me it happened and then I watched it, and even watching it back last night, there are, you know, there's a huge delay after the pin, and Gorilla Monsoon says, oh, this has to be a disqualification. And, you know, I was wanting to believe watching it 30 years ago that that was the case. And then they announced Sergeant Slaughter's the champion. I'm like, you got to be kidding me. This is crazy. Now, this obviously happens in the middle of the card and we eventually get to the Royal Rumble match itself. This is 1991. This is 2 years before we define the winner of the Rumble as going on to WrestleMania. But do you remember, you know, again, this was 30 years ago. Did you have an inclination then that this was going to be impactful? Because the previous couple of Royal Rumbles, again, this is 1991, so 88, it was the one on TV on USA with 20 men. 89 was the first one on pay-per-view. John Studd wins that and goes on to be the referee at WrestleMania. 90, Hulk Hogan wins, but he's already the champion. And then 91, do you assume that this is going to be a championship spot? You know, because then a year later, it's actually for the title.
No, I don't think until they made it an official thing in 93 that the winner would go on. And, you know, I think naming the Rumble winner as automatic WrestleMania challenger, it has lost its luster after, you know, nearly 30 years, and especially given that we now have a February and in, you know, in 2021, we have a March pay-per-view as well before WrestleMania. So dragging that stipulation out for 2-3 months, you know, or 2 or 3 shows hurts it, especially I think it hurts the unpredictability of the winner because,
you know,
if you look at everyone who's in the match, there's only usually like 3 or 4 guys that you could say like, okay, unless they pull a swerve, you know, credible winners to go on to Mania, you just don't have it. And, you know, watching the 91 Royal Rumble, it really kind of surprised me because I'd watched a couple of other Rumbles earlier in the week. And, you know, the amount of Hall of Fame or Hall of Fame potential people that are in this match. Mm-hmm. And I found this to be a very dull Rumble match because this is only the third or fourth that they've done. I don't think they've gotten the formula down on how to integrate storylines into the match itself. It's just, okay, this guy goes out and then this guy, and then, you know, so I found the storytelling of this match to be pretty underwhelming, but yeah, your thoughts before I...
Yeah, no, I agree. You know, as I said, for me, the Royal Rumble is like second, and it's a close second behind WrestleMania in terms of my fandom of pay-per-view events. There were always 2 shows that I took, you know, when I was working at WSIL and getting up in the middle of the night to go into work, there were 2 shows that I always took that Monday off for, and it was the Royal Rumble and WrestleMania. So I love the Royal Rumble, but I agree with you. For the match to me that is the most memorable and that stands out the most to be the championship match and not the actual Royal Rumble match, I think is kind of telling because, like you said, there were no, you know, I like in the, you know, I put the 2020 Royal Rumble as one of my favorites. It's in my top 5 for sure. From this past year, you know, and I liked it because it was different. Brock Lesnar being in there in that number one spot and just depositing everybody over the top rope, you know, it was that constant boom, 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 you know, I feel like the Royal Rumble needs to not just turn into a battle royal. And there were times in the 1991 event that you had 10 or 12 guys in the ring at once. And to me, the beauty of the Rumble is, you know, those moments when, you know, like when Austin, for example, in 97 had everybody out and he's waiting for the next person. And then all of a sudden it's Bret Hart who is his biggest rival, or in 92 when Flair had eliminated everybody. And then here comes Rowdy Roddy Piper. So this Rumble lacked that kind of, and I know you can't do that every single year, but there were no, other than probably Bushwhacker Luke's deposit over, you know, getting thrown out over the top rope. To me, there was nothing that was really that memorable about this match, like you said.
Yeah, I think other than Jake Roberts and Rick Martel going at each other and chasing each other around ringside, and that would lead, I believe, into the blindfold match at WrestleMania. Mm-hmm. There was nothing in this. And I just watched the 2011, I think it was, Rumble a few days ago, and that's the one where CM Punk is leading the Straight Edge Society. And so he comes in and clears the ring and would get on the mic and, you know, talk about being straight edge and everything. And it went through like two or three people before finally Triple H comes out and, you know, puts an end to Punk's throwing every, being alone in the ring. Words escape me. But I was really surprised with the 91 level of entries, because I forgot that the Hart Foundation were faces at the time.
And they were the tag team champions.
They were the tag team champions. And the first four people into the match are Bret Hart, Dino Bravo, Greg Valentine, and Paul Roma. And I'm like, why are we starting with four heels out of the gate? And then realized, like, oh, wait, Bret is the face in this. But still, you know, Dino, Hammer, Roma, like, none of these guys are really.
I feel like Greg Valentine was a tweener.
I think, yes. I would say that.
Right after Dino Bravo, and they had been, you know, because Jimmy Hart had managed him as well. So I was unsure on that too, like you said, when they did that. And then I thought back, because I know, and I believe, and this is kind of another side tangent, but another, you know, one of those guys that was given, you know, right out the gate this giant push was Earthquake, who, you know, had feuded with Hogan up until, actually, I guess probably this Royal Rumble kind of marked the end of that. But, mm-hmm. you know, Earthquake wrestles Greg Valentine then at WrestleMania later this year. So it just seemed like kind of a weird thing to me that, you know, some of the pairings and like you said, the number, to me, the number one and number two also can do a lot to set the tone and set the mm-hmm. pace for the entire match. And Bret Hart and Dino Bravo, no disrespect to Dino Bravo, but I would have gone with someone else. You know, that 1989 Rumble stands out to me as when it was Axe and Smash as number one and number two. Mm-hmm. And again, you can't repeat tag teams going at it, you know, as number one and number two every year, but I feel like you have to diversify it a little bit more with, because you are setting that pace and getting everybody kind of pumped up and excited and putting plausible people in those roles, you know, because in those early days, it was unheard of for anyone at number one or two to survive. And it wasn't until 92 when Flair was number three that, you know, he was the earliest entrant. And then eventually we saw Chris Benoit and Shawn Michaels and probably a couple of other guys that I'm forgetting that, you know, survived and went the whole time. So.
Yeah. And I probably would have had Perfect come in at number two, just because Perfect and Bret, I think both could have, like you said, set the pace and could have been in there for a lengthy amount of time. I mean, Dino Bravo was only in there for 3 minutes. Yeah. So, you know, and getting back to your point about Greg Valentine. Yeah. I remember when, I think Jimmy Hart was at ringside with Dino Bravo and Greg and Jimmy kind of had a little shouting match at each other. So, yeah. And I guess looking back again, this is, you know, when you have guys who are, you know, more well known for being being on one side of the fence, you don't know where they are, you know. So especially if he went back now and watched a Royal Rumble with a Big Show in it, who knows which side he's on at that point. But what I found interesting going through the list of people coming in is you had all these tag team partners that were in there. Like you mentioned, you had the Hart Foundation, you had Bushwhackers. You know, Earthquake and Tugboat weren't a tag team yet, but they were there. But
Power and Glory,
exactly. And I was surprised that when Knobs came out, one, I can't believe how young Knobs looked. I don't remember him looking so young. But I was like, okay, well, Sags has got to come in at some point. But Sags never did. I just looked up that he was on the Dark match. He defeated Sam Houston. But I'm like, I think he could have pulled double duty that night. Like, why was it? Yeah, you had Hawk, Legion of Doom in there as well.
Yeah, there were five tag teams in there, and then, you know, I guess half of one in Nasty Boy Knobs. But yeah, I agree. And Knobs was in the final three, which I also found very perplexing.
Well, I think he's good friends with Hogan, so
that is true. I do believe you're correct on that.
Yeah.
And I guess technically speaking, too, we're talking about a 29-man Royal Rumble, really, because at the end, and I do like the way the announcers sold this, because Roddy Piper and Gorilla Monsoon are on commentary, but we get to number 18 and no one comes out. And it's, you know, well, who's supposed to be number 18? And it made sense, because when Warrior lost the championship, he didn't stick around and pose or, you know, anything like that. He darted off to the back to find the Macho King. And so it's presumed and that Warrior found the Macho King, but we never saw it. But I do like that continuity and kind of keeping that story alive and keeping Savage, even though I would have loved to have seen Savage in the Rumble. The story they were telling again was to me a pretty good one.
Yeah. And I think, you know, if that had been done today, we would have cut to the back and seen Savage and Sherry getting into a car and taking off, and Warrior just barely getting there right after they left. But yeah, I mean, and I like that the way that they, like you said, the announcers sell it, because they're like, okay, who was it supposed to be? It wasn't, oh, that was supposed to be Savage and now he's out. It wasn't until they got down to like number 29 and they're like, well, we only have two people left.
Yeah.
So whoever comes out, and then finally admitting that it was Savage. And I think that's, you know, one of those little details that is probably overproduced in today's wrestling market, because they would have hit us over the head with, oh, Savage should be here, but he wasn't.
Yeah, because it makes more sense this way too, because, you know, as the announce team, we have a list of everyone that's in the Rumble, because they do the whole, you know, back then they didn't have surprises like they do today. So at the open of the show, you would see all the little heads pop up, or they would do the vignettes or the promos or whatever. So you pretty much knew who was going to be a part of the Royal Rumble. So, you know, for them to jump to that, finally be able to jump to that, okay, well, Savage was supposed to be number 18 because he's the only one on our list that's not out here. So I did like that, and wanted to make a note of that and talk about it on the podcast. But
yeah. I'll ask you real quick.
Yeah.
Speaking of differences of presentation, you know, this at this point, there's no Titantron. Mm-hmm. And when a person comes out, they don't start playing the theme music. Guys just run to the ring.
Yeah.
Do you... I can understand now why they posted on the Titantron and why they play the music, because that gets the crowd reaction immediate. But I also like that the guys in the ring didn't pay attention to who was coming out next. Like, right. You know, now it'd be like, you know, if someone's music hits, whoever they're feuding with will automatically like stop and look toward the ring. Whereas this would give that guy time to come in and attack from behind, or, you know, so I say, which would you prefer? Would you prefer telegraphing who's coming in, or just waiting until he hits the ring to get the reaction?
Well, you know what? That's a great question. And I noticed that too. You know, I liked the lack of, knowing, you know, until they come through and you see who it is. I thought a couple of things about that and then something else. But when... I think it was Paul Roma, whoever Slick's first guy to come out was. Slick is like running side by, like he's keeping up with him. I was impressed. He's, you know, in his suit and he's running right along with him. I thought that was funny. Like some of the managers are, you know, in a more rush. Obviously when Brother Love came out with The Undertaker, it was a faster pace than The Undertaker we see these days, or, you know, when Taker was still wrestling. But then Kerry Von Erich, who, you know, Texas Tornado, one of my all time favorites, reportedly had lost a foot, you know, had a prosthetic foot or whatever. And I mean, he charges down there too pretty quick. But back to your original point, I don't think the 2020 Royal Rumble with Edge's return would have been as impactful had they not done the "You Think You Know Me" and then the fireworks and him coming up. I'm getting goosebumps talking about that, right? Because to me, that was one of the best moments of 2020 in general, but for that Royal Rumble as well. I just love that. And I don't think him just running out to the ring would have been as impactful. But overall, because you're not going to obviously have 30 surprises every year, overall, I prefer the lack of music and fanfare as they make their way out.
Yeah, I say, you know, maybe save it for that one, because, you know, thinking back to at the Rumble where John Cena was the surprise number 30 entrant, who was supposed to, you know, out injured, and he's just standing in the entranceway while his music's playing and the crowd's going crazy. But yeah, I guess if you used it sparingly to, but again, I guess, you know, that's the other thing that we can segue into is the surprises in the Rumble, which have become a tradition now. And, you know, it's one of those things where you, you know, unless they pull off the ultimate surprise, that person's not going to win the Rumble if, you know, if they're not on the roster. But do you think that the surprises are still, are they worthy, or are they a distraction from the match to get that cheap pop and, you know, to throw someone in there that we know isn't going to win?
You know, I love nostalgia. We've talked about this a lot, you know, so when Doink the Clown or Razor Ramon or, you know, even the Boogeyman, even though the Boogeyman is not, to me, nostalgic, even though it's been 15 years, but, you know, when those guys come out, I don't view it any differently. You know, I know some would probably argue and maybe even have a valid point of, you know, are these people taking away a slot from someone else on the active roster, especially now that you have three brands with NXT as well. I think it's easy to overlook and leave guys who are worthy and should be in that match out. But I also, you know, I think if you limit it to no more than three surprises, I'm fine with that. The only other solution I would see is making it a 40-man Rumble. But I also think on the women's side, without the surprises, I don't know that you have enough women on the roster to have a 30-woman Rumble match. So it's a delicate balancing act, but I think that it's, you know, through the years has become, you know, one of those things like the Undertaker streak at WrestleMania. You know, who's going to be the surprise entrant into the Royal Rumble? Or, you know, we haven't seen it, I don't think, in the last couple of years, but Kofi Kingston and then the creative exits that he had. Mm-hmm. So the Royal Rumble, while you would think it could stand on its own, it does need, I think, little tweaks or little things to make it a more interesting, more thought-provoking, more talk, you know. You know, 1991, if we weren't doing this as an anniversary episode of the Royal Rumble, there's nothing that happened in this match that to me would be worth doing an hour-long podcast on. So, but the 92 Royal Rumble, I feel like, was much more significant. 97 with Austin, you know, cheating and coming back in. The 2020, again, I can't talk enough about the 2020 Royal Rumble. So I feel like, without adding some of these little extras to it, you know, it was like when they watered down the Survivor Series. I don't think that was a good thing when they took away the elimination. You know, to me, that was what Survivor Series was supposed to be, was elimination matches. And then you watered it down by taking that away first, and then you have bragging rights a month and a half or 2 months before, and then you do a SummerSlam with a 10-man elimination event. You know, if WWF did a bunch of battle royals, and I do think that, and I'm rambling here, but mm-hmm. I feel like in a way the Andre the Giant Memorial Battle Royal, I love the idea of memorializing Andre, and I love that everyone gets a shot to be at WrestleMania, but I still feel like and maintain that that should have just been for the 30 year, like do it on the anniversary shows, WrestleMania 30, WrestleMania 35, WrestleMania 40, because it's too close to the Royal Rumble. And I feel like it they take away from each other. There's not as much luster with it, I guess, as, you know, now it's just a thing where everybody's going to be in and someone's going to win this giant trophy and we're not going to really do anything with them as a result of that.
Yeah, I was going to say that, you know, the problem I have with the Andre Battle Royal is that nothing ever comes of it. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just, and it is a way just to get everybody on the show, which, great, I guess. You know, and who knows, you know, in the past, it would be like, oh, if you're on the show, you get a pay-per-view bonus. I don't know how that works now, and I don't really care because I don't work for the company and I'm not getting paid. So I want to just be a fan and sit back and watch it. But I, you know, I think that's one of the other issues with WrestleMania, and going off onto a tangent of, does everybody need to be on the show? Or, you know, because to me, WrestleMania should be the wrap up of stories that have gone on over the year, because I'm old school in my thinking and I hate change. So I'm going to yell at some more clouds later this afternoon. But yeah, I mean, I think, like we said, the putting the title, WrestleMania title stipulation into the Rumble was a good idea back in the day when you would go from the Rumble to Mania, so you could build up that match. Now that you have split brands, now that you have more shows in between, and you know, your weekly show is also just as almost as important as a pay-per-view every week now. I don't think, I would like to see that stipulation taken away, just so that, or, you know, change it to title match at the next pay-per-view or something like that.
Yeah.
And I would like to see more surprise winners. You know, a couple of years ago when Alberto Del Rio won and it came down to him and Santino, the crowd wanted Santino.
Yeah.
And, you know, it would have been great if they would have been able to change the finish on the fly and give Santino that match and really send the crowd home happy. And then, again, you could have Del Rio challenge him at Elimination Chamber for that title match spot, you know.
Right.
I agree. Again, I don't think you can overdo that stipulation either of losing your championship match. But, you know, certain times, like you said, if you use it every few years sparingly, it's a storyline crutch that you could fall back on. But, yeah, I would like to see some surprise Rumble winners.
Yeah. Well, and something that you and I have talked about before on this show is that recall of those early years, you know, the early WrestleManias, the early Royal Rumbles, the early Survivor Series events, the early SummerSlams. You know, we could run down and remember the cards, or at least remember the people that were involved. And you surprised me when you snapped me, because if I sat down and had written without going and looking, obviously now we've looked at Wikipedia and we've watched the Rumble itself, but had somebody said to me before we did that, write down the 30 participants in the 1991 Royal Rumble, I probably would have gotten about 95% of them. But one person I would have never thought of is Shane Douglas. And you had snapped me and said, I totally forgot Shane Douglas was in the Royal Rumble. Now, do you remember his very first run? This is obviously long before Dean Douglas, and this is way before the days of ECW, but this is mullet Shane Douglas and, you know, young early 20s Shane Douglas, who was fresh off of the UWF and was pretty rising star there, but never really resonated in WWF. Do you remember anything about that first run for him?
No, I don't remember him being in WWF at all. I remember, you know, the Dynamic Dudes from WCW with him and Johnny Ace. And then I would have said, you know, if you asked me to do a, with no research, history report on the history of Shane Douglas, I would have said Dynamic Dude, brief ECW, you know, championship run, Dean Douglas briefly, then back to ECW, then WCW. Like, I have no recollection of him even prior in the UWF.
Yeah, I remember him in the UWF because Sting had kind of taken him under his wing when Sting turned face. And I remember him being in the WWF only, again, going back to those After magazines, and there was an article or something about him being there, or a picture of something. I don't remember, but I couldn't tell you if he wrestled on Saturday Night's Main Event. I don't remember him being on Superstars. And until sitting down and rewatching it, the Royal Rumble, and that may have been his only pay-per-view appearance during that run. It wasn't a very long run, I don't think. And yeah, he went back to WCW shortly after this. And I believe he and Ricky Steamboat maybe were champions. So, yeah. You know, that's what I kind of remember of that. But yeah, I was kind of surprised as well. And he actually lasted a while in there. And I don't think he eliminated anybody, but he, you know, had a decent showing, I guess, for someone.
He was in there for almost a half hour, 26 minutes. But yeah, he came in at number 17 and was the 21st person eliminated.
Wow.
I'm looking up his Wikipedia right now just to see if, it says his most memorable WWF performance took place at the 91 Royal Rumble. Shortly after that, he left the company to take care of his father.
Okay. Well, you know, and we talked about the tag teams in there, Hawk and Animal, the Road Warriors, or the Legion of Doom in the WWF, probably the second most impressive elimination, I think. Eliminating the Undertaker, you know, doing that double clothesline and sending the Undertaker over the top rope, because the Undertaker, I thought the Undertaker when he came out was going to be more, they were going to do him more as a, you know, like Diesel and Kane, where they set the record for eliminations that year. And I don't think that Undertaker eliminated a whole lot of people during his time in there in his first Royal Rumble match, but I found it, you know, interesting that it was the Road Warriors that eliminated him. And then like almost instantly after that, Hawk gets eliminated. So that tag team aspect was quickly eliminated and taken out of it. But again, who would have thought 30 years later, the Undertaker would have the career that he ended up having and later this year going on and winning the championship for the first time.
Yeah. I was kind of surprised. I mean, because I was thinking this was Undertaker's first, or, well, I mean, it was his second pay-per-view, but his first one since his debut. So, you know, and I don't know how much he'd been on television in between, because there wasn't Monday Night Raw as there is now, or SmackDown. You know, it's the syndicated shows, so yeah. I don't know how he had been built up. But, yeah, I mean, obviously you can see, like, it's still very early Undertaker. He's got some of the mannerisms, but he's not quite the Undertaker that we all know now.
Yeah.
And yeah, I, you know, and I was trying to think, because I think he and I was trying to remember if he went on to face Snuka at this Mania. Okay.
Yeah,
so I think they had a little bit of interaction in the match itself. But yeah, again, it's, you know, today we see more storylines play out that come into play later, but yeah, Taker was, you know, he had three eliminations, but I guess for an earlier appearance, good for him.
Yeah, yeah, and I don't know that they knew exactly what they were going to do with him at that point. You know, I briefly mentioned Bushwhacker Luke. You know, he runs down or comes down doing the Bushwhacker walk and gets in the ring, and Earthquake grabs him and just walks him across and dumps him out. And he continues to do the Bushwhacker walk. And, you know, to me, that was, you know, it was funny. It was memorable. You know, it was one of those first real quick eliminations where I feel like we talked earlier about traditions with the Rumble, you know, you always have someone that's eliminated pretty quickly. You have someone that, you know, goes the distance. You have someone that eliminates the most people. And then of course your overall winner. So I feel like every year you have, someone that you can kind of talk about or remember. But, you know, when it's one of the first, it's the most memorable, because I couldn't tell you who last year's, you know, Bushwhacker Luke was, for example, but I'm sure someone out there knows it right off the top of their head, but I'm not that guy. And like I said, I loved the 2020 Royal Rumble.
Yeah. I mean, I'm going to assume that it was somebody during the Brock Lesnar, not demolition. Again, I need a thesaurus when we start doing these shows so I can look up words. But yeah, it is one of those things where it's like, yes, again, I think that's one of the things that makes the Rumble so interesting are the traditions. Last year, Eric Rowan lasted 8 seconds.
Okay. All right. Well, there you have it.
And John Morrison lasted 9 seconds. And Cesaro lasted 18 seconds.
That's right. I was so disappointed that Morrison, because Morrison had just come back and was eliminated so quick. I remember that now. Okay.
Yeah. There were a lot of quicker eliminations last year. Brock, again, because of Brock being so dominant, which is the word I was looking for. But you know, so I mean, I don't know if you want to go into this now or we can save it for later. Who for the 2021 Royal Rumble is your pick to win?
Well, yeah, I was going to wrap things up with that, and we are approaching the hour mark, so we're close to being done here. Before we do, though, I want to say real quick just another couple of factoids about the 91 Rumble. We mentioned it off the top. Hogan, this is the first person to become a dual winner, back-to-back winner. Obviously, through the years, we've had several superstars that have done that. But 1991 Royal Rumble, Chad, overall, what do you think of it? Good, bad? And, you know, how? I think it's probably one of the more least, the one of the most least memorable, if that's even a way to say that. But you know what I'm trying to say here.
Yeah, like I said earlier, watching it back, it just, for the level of talent in this match, there's nothing memorable about the match. Like, yeah. Other than, like you said, Bushwhacker Luke or the debut of Undertaker. But other than that, there's nothing in there that stands the test of time as, oh, remember this moment from past Royal Rumble. So, yeah, this was just it's a match there to get Hogan the victory and push him on the way to challenging Slaughter.
Agreed. So back to your question, the 2021 Royal Rumble, and I am going to humble brag here. Last year, I picked all 8 matches right for the 2020 Royal Rumble in the little, I don't get anything other than a pat on my back that I did that, but I picked the winners of both Rumble matches and all the undercard stuff. So that being said, I have no idea for this year because the quote unquote dirt sheets, the odds on favorite or whatever you want to say, has been pushing or pointing towards Daniel Bryan, which I would love to see that. Daniel Bryan is one of my favorite guys on the current modern day roster. But the way they've been treating Cesaro lately, I'm wondering if we're going to get some kind of push for him. I would love to see that, but I'm going to go with either Cesaro or Daniel Bryan as my pick to win the Royal Rumble.
Yeah, according to dirt sheet rumors, is no WrestleMania matches are set in place yet because I guess they're still waiting to see, you know, what they're going to be doing with Mania. But so, you know, in a sense, maybe that's good. Maybe we'll have another year where we don't know who the winner is going to be. And, you know, that's something that, as we've said all throughout this show, that makes a better Royal Rumble match, because if you don't know who it's going to be, and especially now with, you know, split brands and each one getting a title shot, you could, again, you, and I think this is where you could throw in a lesser, you know, I don't want to say lesser talent, but someone who isn't the foregone conclusion and have them take one title match and then whoever, you know, your top name would be going into your other title match. But yeah, I, you know, both women's and men's Rumble matches, I have no clue who we're going to see. So I just hope it's, you know, a good match. And obviously without, this will be the first one with no audience. So I would almost say, like, I don't expect many surprises because,
yeah,
if you're not going to get the pop, then why take that spot and bring someone in just for the day? But yeah, I am looking forward to it. And I'm still going to try to talk you into coming with me to WrestleMania. So,
well, I would love to see, on the women's side of things, I would love to see Bianca Belair win the women's Rumble match. And I know her and Bayley are doing something right now, but because Sasha's still the women's champion for SmackDown, right?
Yes.
So yeah, I would love to see them do something more with Bianca Belair. And again, it'll be interesting to see too, will they do the, you know, because last year we didn't have the Kofi. I don't think we had a Kofi
spot.
Creative spot, but we had it with Mandy Rose in the women's match. So will we see something like that this year. You know, will they do that without a crowd there or not? Because part of it is, you know, that crowd response. But I think, you know, things that will get folks talking is always a good thing as well. So we'll have to wait and see. But you're not going to go out on a limb and pick a winner? What about Goldberg and McIntyre?
I hope Goldberg does not win. Like, and the whole thing with that, where when Goldberg came out and time, they were running out of time, so McIntyre didn't get to say anything, and Goldberg comes out and is like, I've heard you disrespecting these legends, and like, what? No, McIntyre hasn't said anything like that. What? So, you know, one of my reasons of wanting to go to WrestleMania this year, other than the fact that just getting back to some sense of normalcy in life and get out, as I was thinking about the other day, is I've never seen Goldberg wrestle in person. And if he's going to be at Mania, then can, you know, cross that off the list, even though it's not actually on my list of things to do. But yeah, we don't need to bring Goldberg out every, you know, few months. Like, just let him ride off into the sunset and I'll be happy. So yeah, I think McIntyre, you know, we've said it before too, where unfortunately for McIntyre, I think he's had a great year, but without a lack of crowd presence, like he hasn't gotten that moment to really shine and get the adulation that I think he would have gotten had, you know, had the crowd been there.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
Well, on that note, I think we're going to wrap up the Rumble discussion. And again, I love talking about old Rumbles, and I love talking about the current Rumbles as well. So it's always a fun topic, to say the very least. Chad, anything else you want to say before we wrap things up?
No, I think we've rumbled this Rumble to rumbling. So now my tummy's rumbling, and maybe I need to get something to eat.
Time to go eat. Alrighty, friends. Thank you so much for tuning in. Again, check out the My123Cents Facebook group, the Facebook page, the blog page, the YouTube channel. We're trying to do it all here. So check it all out, and we appreciate the support, and we will talk again very soon.
It's time for school, but you're not going to be saved by this bell. Established in 2016, Stride Pro Wrestling trainers have put their years of experience to help train the next generation of professional wrestlers. Nearly a dozen students have graduated and are now making a name for themselves, not only here at Stride Pro Wrestling, but beyond. Our athletes aren't locked into any long-term contracts. So if you want to train, use your head and contact Stride Pro Wrestling today. It's training you'll flip for. So kick your future into high gear now.
This is a production of the Jittery Monkey Podcast Network. For more jittery shenanigans, go to jitterymonkey.com.